We would like to advise that the following program may contain real news, occasional philosophy, and ideas that may offend some listeners.
We have to talk about generative AI, more ChatGPT.
It's inescapable, inevitable, really. So we thought we need to rope in one of the leading technology thinkers.
And writers.
And one of our intellectual heroes, really, Kevin Kelly, the co-founder of Wired magazine.
Who today also holds the awesome title of Chief Senior Maverick at Wired. I have title envy.
We all have title envy. And Kevin's such a nice guy too.
So Kevin gave this fantastically interesting talk at South by Southwest recently.
And he was kind enough to sit down with us afterwards for an interview.
And the thing about Kevin is that he's one of those original thinkers. So he had some really interesting observations about generative AI, ChatGPT, all of these.
Yeah, for example, and Kevin is an eternal optimist when it comes to technology, but he's not really concerned that we or anyone really will lose their jobs. AI is not coming for our job, but AIs are coming for our job descriptions.
Yes, and it is plural, according to Kevin. There are many AIs.
But they will not replace us. They'll be more like, you know, interns, assistants.
And what's important is that we will really have to learn how to work with these assistants.
He says it will become part of a required skill set.
Everyone's skill set, really.
We'll all need to continuously skill up. We'll be perpetual newbies.
So let's hear what you have to say about these technologies and how they are changing our world.
And you really have to stay until the end because Kevin also has a wealth of really useful and
funny.
Really funny life advice that he agreed to share before his upcoming book is released.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
From the University of Sydney Business School, this is Sydney Business Insights, an initiative that explores the future of business. And you're listening to The Future This Week, where Sandra Peter and Kai Rima sit down every week to rethink trends in technology and business.
My name is Kevin Kelly, and I am the senior maverick at Wired Magazine, but better known as the co-founder of Wired Magazine. There were at least five of us, and these days I'm also an author of books about the future and the culture of technology.
Thank you for taking the time to talk to us. Let's start by talking a little bit about AI. It's on everybody's minds these days. Overhyped or underhyped?
In the long run, it's underhyped because I think the effects of this will be centuries in the making and will affect us deeply, and not just affect us in a kind of superficial way, but actually reshape humans and reshape us. And so it's probably overhyped in the near term because I think some of the employment disruption that people expect is not going to happen in the way it's going to be more positive. And I think the general speed will again not continue at the pace it is right now. I think we're going to have these little plateaus, little quantum leaps. We're in one right now, but it's unlikely to sustain at this rate for a decade or more. So it's a little bit overhyped right now.
But you're saying in the long term, underhyped. Why is that?
Because so far this planet, we've had a very peculiar history in terms of the galactic possibilities, because on this planet, we have no other species that are close to us in our kind of thinking. We could easily imagine other planets where there have been multiple related species that might have been almost like us. But there's a huge gap between us and gorillas, say, chimpanzees. But now we're going to fill that gap. And we don't have a lot of experience with living in a world where there are multiple species of sentience or intelligence and other kinds of minds. And that's sort of what we're going to be doing in the long term.
So when you say in the short term, it's overhyped, we hear a lot about job losses. You're not too worried about that?
Not at all. No one really is going to, very, very few, but let's round it off to no one, is going to lose their job, but you're going to lose your job description.
Right.
Most jobs are bundles of different tasks, and a lot of those tasks will be lost. But the job description shifts and you have some new tasks, including things like working with the AIs.
So as AI comes into our world, into our workplaces, what do you think the relationship will be that we form with these AIs as they come in?
My guess for the initial time, like right now, in the next 5 years, is that the relationship will be of seeing them as interns, as assistants, as co-pilots, as colleagues, as someone that we work with, but I think not on an equal basis, but like an intern, where they're supporting us to do our job. Doctors will use them tremendously in diagnosing, because they, the interns, can command a much broader wealth of knowledge that keep updated. And designers will use them to make prototypes, alternative ideas. Writers use them. Coders are already dependent on them. Most people will find them useful. If you find Google useful right now at all, you'll find these interns even more useful, because they are not just answering questions. They continue to answer questions, but they also can generate things as well.
What's the space you think this will be particularly interesting in? Because you discussed this idea of the in-between spaces, in-between domains. How do we think about that?
Yeah, so one of the surprising and unfilled roles right now that these are very, very suited for, we're discovering, is in imagining, fulfilling, answering things that are the white spaces, where you have two distinct fields that don't seem to intersect. And to imagine something that combines those is something we can do, but the details and the mastery require of it means that we would not normally do it unless we were willing to pay the expense of hours and hours and hours of trying to do it. And here, these AIs can do them very, very quickly. And so you can take almost any kind of random two subjects and ask it to combine or to hybridize or to marry them or to find something that's in between that connects them. And again, it's something that we can imagine doing, but requires so much effort to do that it rarely is done. But here they can just do thousands of them very, very quickly, and that is a kind of creativity. In fact, it's almost some people's definition of creativity is to take two things that don't normally intersect and intersect them. And so this is tremendously useful. And it's not the only thing they do, but it's one thing that they do very well.
And we find this both with the text generators and with the image generators.
Exactly, right. So you can combine, say, you know, I'm looking at a table here, a wooden table. So let's say wood and dancing. So give me some ideas about wood and dancing. So is it wood that can dance? Is it a dancing tree? Whatever it is, and we'll just begin to explore that in great detail. And so that can be visually, that can be with text. There's all kinds of ways, and that's what it does very well. It's taking patterns of woodenness and dancing patterns, and it's marrying them, it's hybridizing. It's saying there's another section here where these patterns can join, and nobody has looked at that before. And that's the thrill, is that as the promptor and the prompt engineer, you can kind of explore this combination, which probably has never, ever been explored. And the way that you do it, no one will probably ever be able to get back to it, because there's a random generated element in this. And the possibility space is so huge that it's often impossible to get back to that place. Unless you have the exact seed, then you can get there. Otherwise, you would never be able to arrive there.
That's both exciting,
right,
and also tragic in a way, because we're generating all this wealth of ideas, many of which will never see a broad
audience.
Never
be seen again. In real life, we have those examples of walking along outside in the wilderness, and the flowers are bloom and the lights, and there's something that will never happen again, but you're present. And you appreciate it, and it'll probably never be reconstructed with the exact clouds and everything. And so those moments happen, and we're not disturbed by that they never could happen. That's part of the joy.
But we've never really had that, like, creativity for an audience of one.
Exactly.
At, you know, reasonable cost.
So You mentioned prompt engineers or promptors. It takes a certain skill, right? So what does it take for us as a species or as an economy, as a society, to make best use of these technologies? And what does it mean for workers when you think about skill, for example?
Yeah. So my premise is that working with the AIs, and there'll be many kinds, will become an essential skill set for people in the same way that we now, you have to be able to use the mouse and computer and kind of basically understand how menus and things work. This is sort of a basic life skill at this point, which was not true 30 years ago for sure. And I think we'll come to see that, you know, in your resume, whatever it is, having some familiarity with these AIs, maybe the popular ones, will be an essential part of your resume, is that I'm proficient in prompting whatever, the Google, the Bard. And so some people are going to be better at it because they're going to spend more time. And it is evolving to a kind of language, even though we are using, or whatever your native language, to interact, we'll call it natural language. You're using a natural language to interact with the AIs. There'll be still specialized vocabulary, a specialized, like a sub-language for those who do it really well. It's like a keyboard shortcut. They'll have language shortcuts to get these AIs to do what they want to do. And that kind of language shortcut is a skill that you can acquire from 1,000 hours of doing it.
Does it mean that we need to reskill across the board? We always thought of reskilling for people whose jobs become outdated, or particular parts of society, or underskilled workers. But now I'm thinking, you know, we're reskilling PhD students, we're reskilling doctors, we're reskilling people who are at the cutting edge of their field.
I think that's a perfect way to put it. It's perpetual reskilling. Because I talk about the perpetual newbie and how all of us, no matter what age we are going to be a newbie, lifelong learning. And the young people, the millennials today, kind of say, oh, I'm a digital native, you know, I have an advantage. And I'm saying, well, yes, but you are not going to be a digital native in 5 years from now. And so you're going to have to relearn and reskill, as you say, like the rest of us. So that advantage is very short. You're only a digital native for 5 years, and then you have to reskill.
I know when you talk about technology, you usually have a long-term optimistic view of where this will take us. But I do want to ask you whether there's anything you're worried about.
Yeah, there are some few things. I'm worried about the weaponization of AI. Maybe not in the way you think, because actually I favor, theoretically, robo-soldiers. I think soldiers, you actually may be able to better program them so they don't have war crimes, or they're not, you know, emotional. So we have rules of war, and rules of war are very strange, because it's like, they're strange because we allow war at all. But if you have war, it's better to have rules of war, but actually it's better not to have war. And so I think the idea of like programming soldiers to kill, which can kill more kind of fairly without war crimes and stuff, will heighten the absurdity of what we have. No, we want humans to kill. Only humans are allowed to kill other humans. That's like crazy too. So I think it might help us to diminish war if we had robots doing it, and they might do it better. But the kind of AI and weaponization that I'm more concerned about is applying AI to cyber war. And cyber war itself is very scary to me, because we don't have really good rules for it. We don't have an agreement on what's allowed and what's not allowed. And it's very hard to have things accountable and proving it. And so I think there's just real potential for harm and disruption with AI and cyber war. And so the solution would be to have agreements, to have treaties about what is allowed and not allowed.
Like we did for nuclear or for
weapons and
biological
weapons. Exactly.
Yeah. And the chances of that?
Well, you know, I think there are low-level things happening right now. And again, all parties are involved, and I'm sure the United States, my country, is involved. And thus the problem is, if you have tanks, you can take aerial photographs and see them. Right now, there's no transparency in this, and so we don't even know what's going on, which is part of the reason why I'm worried about it.
How worried are you about bias in AI? I mean, at some level, this AI works because there are all these patterns and distinctions in the world to begin with, right? But some of those patterns we tolerate less, we don't want in whatever the outcome is that AI generates.
The biases are there, they're real, and they're real because the bots are trained on the whole of human content, human generators, from the best that we've ever done to the worst. And also, by the way, some of our greatest literature is full of really bad behavior. So it's inevitable.
Sometimes that makes them great.
Exactly, right. So it's like even the noble works depict really horrible things. So it's sort of inevitable that these bots will be biased in terms of ageism, racism, sexism, war mongering, etc. And so we shouldn't really be surprised, but we collectively are not going to tolerate it. And I agree. But the issue is that since we want them to act better than us, we don't really have a very good model of what that means. The first approximation, is that you just make them woke. You just woke them up. But, well, first of all, we don't have any consensus on that. And secondly, I'm not sure that that is actually what we want. And so we don't have very good pictures in our head, and we don't have the consensus on that to actually be able to model and to give the code to them. And so I think part of this discussion right now, at least in the States that we're having about wokeness, is going to be amplified and expanded and maybe deepened as we try to think about, well, what is a superior behavior? What does that look like?
We're kind of hypocritical towards these AIs, right? Because they just reflect our own behaviors back at us, and we don't tolerate it anymore.
Right, exactly.
We struggle to agree on standards for autonomous vehicles across different nations and different ethical systems. So I think agreeing on this is one of the fears. How do you think about groupthink when it comes to...
Do you want my independent opinion or my groupthink opinion?
Both.
How do I think about groupthink? Well, it's perfectly fine. I don't know. So, to be more serious, a lot of what everybody knows is absolutely correct. So we tend to often dismiss what everybody knows. But most of what everybody knows, most of the acceptable conventional wisdom is absolutely true. Capital of England is London. Okay, everybody knows that. That's true. So I would say some very large percentage of groupthink is correct. So there's a little bit of tension because we want only a small amount of it to be independent thinking to help improve or to advance the groupthink. And so science works by taking kind of new ideas and making it the consensus. And so we do want that groupthink.
Are you worried that this is breaking down the groupthink? Do we need more?
No, I think there's plenty of agreement, and I think there's some political areas and others where there is not, but by and large, there's still, the majority is consensus. What we want, though, is there are often areas where there is consensus where there shouldn't be necessarily, and that's where science and other places advance, or in cultural change. Most of our thinking right now is how to facilitate changing your mind. I'm not too worried about where we have agreement.
You were talking about consensus and common sense. One thing that you're suggesting we do change our mind on is how we think about ownership in this space, how we think about rights in this space. Mm-hmm. And you were suggesting shifting our mindset from thinking in terms of copyright to reference rights or rights of reference. Can you talk a bit about that?
It's been clear since the advent of the digital era that the old industrial model for intellectual property revolves around copies, and that just has broken down in many ways. And for a long time, there was a resistance to streaming because it seemed to have gone against the current of protecting copies because everything is just flowing. And so right now, there's an attempt to kind of put the generative AI to think of it in terms of copies of things. And it just doesn't fit. It's just very, very hard. And we have some aspects of the copyright law which are focused on human creators. And that also isn't going to survive, because it's very clear that we can have machine creators. And so there's an attempt right now to kind of squeeze the intellectual property regimes of these things into this existing copyright mold, and I don't think it's going to work. It's already not working with the digital stuff very well, but we have some kind of half-baked idea, but now it's just simply not going to work. And so I'm totally in favor of having these temporary monopolies given to creators, even though I believe my own version of innovation is that if you didn't write the book or invent the patent, someone right after you is going to. Nonetheless, it is an incentive to have a temporary monopoly, but it needs to be very short. And so what should that monopoly be based around, and what rights should you have, etc.? As I said, right now we have just one, which is copies of things, but I think we can change that or shift that in the world of AI and talk about another possible way of structuring it, which is referencing. And this goes to this idea that the humans, or even the machines that train in AI, might have some credit or might have some stake in what's made later on. What we might say is that it's not just the AI making it, but it's the AI plus all the other people who are being drawn on to create that thing. So what we don't really know, and this is true, is we really don't know how these black boxes are working. Just as you and I can't really unravel who influenced us in my thinking and to what extent. So when I'm saying something right now, most of probably what I'm saying has come from my background and training and my experience, being possible for me to kind of unravel who has influenced me more in what I just said.
Oh, I've got this guy called Kevin Kelly
exactly,
or something.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So this attempt may not work, but it would work better than copies. And so there is some work right now trying to unravel influence and assign weights and things to each generation. I don't know if it will work. The researchers don't know what it'll work. But again, it has more promise in my eyes than relying on copies.
My understanding is that at this point, there's a somewhat of a trade-off between the ability to explain and assign those references and the power of these systems, that when you make them bigger and more inscrutable, they also become more exciting in the synthesis that they generate.
Right.
So we might solve this, but...
Yes, and there are people trying to do it, reverse engineering, going back through it. And so you're right, there may be certain systems that are set up to track that, and they have a cost. And there are also other ways in which we can have kind of green or clean training sets, where everybody in the training set, they start from scratch and they have opt-in. So you have a curated training set where everybody is participating knowingly with that right of reference. And so I think that's another way that right of reference might be, where you say, okay, my work that I'm producing, like we have Creative Commons license, we could say have a right of reference license. And so anything I produce, I'm okay with it being used to train an AI. And that might be all we need. It's just right of reference, kind of like a Creative Commons mark, which says, I would like to be influential and have people, you know, use as a training for other things. So I think there's a lot of new innovation that we might have to think about in terms of restructuring intellectual property in this age of synthetic creativity.
Every time there's one of these new technologies that comes up, there are all these ideas that we have to invent and innovate, mm-hmm. you know, legal frameworks and all these things around it. But there's also a whole set of ideas that we need to let go or unlearn. Mm. Like you mentioned now, copyright,
right,
the idea
that
this no longer serves us. Are there any other ideas where we need to let go of common sense or maybe invent new words to make sense of what's happening now around AI?
That's a good question.
We've had to do this with platforms, you know.
Yeah.
Antitrust legislation no longer serves us to think about Amazon.
Yeah. Again, just responsibility. So there's a great book by Kate Darling at MIT who was trying to explore parallels with animal ownership and robot ownership. Like, if a self-driving car does something that is a crime or hurts somebody or something, who's responsible? In the way that if in the biblical era, if your ox gored somebody, there was always the question of, well, how much accountability do you as an owner have? You know, the ox went crazy, it was startled, whatever, something happened. Do you have full responsibility, whatever? And so that idea of responsibility, and I think they call it legal tort, is something that will definitely be re-examined. If you have an AI that's making choices or whatever, and it does some harm that nobody anticipated or had never been done before, how much responsibility do other people have? Does the user of it, does the manufacturer, do the programmers have it? So this will be really very new, and some of our older ideas about ownership will have to change, because do we own the AI that we're using? And this is a little bit like what we see in the copyright is, you know, I generate an image. Do I own the image? Does Midjourney own the image? Do the program? I mean, it's like, who owns it? So responsibility in general and tort, I think, are going to be redone, reimagined.
It's interesting that we do find ourselves at this inflection point in technology. So I think a lot of these ideas are things that we'll keep discussing, and I hope we'll come back to you to tell us a bit more about that. But you're not only an amazing tech writer, but for a few years now, you've been sharing your life learnings, and you have advice not only about how to think, but also about how to live. Some of it very, very practical. Your advice on, you know, if you think you've seen a mouse, you probably have, and there's more where that came from. It's very, very true and useful. Yeah, and do you want to share some of your more recent ones? I know you're getting ready to launch a book soon.
Yes, so I have a new book coming out. It's called Excellent Advice for Living, and the subtitle is Wisdom I Wish I Had Known Earlier. And this is the book, and there's this 450 little tiny, almost tweetable bits of advice, and it's aimed at young people and the young at heart. And I try to take a whole book of advice about something very complicated and reduce it to a little tiny sentence. And that's my joy, is if I can do that. So, you know, I'm just picking at random. It says, don't ever work for someone you don't want to become.
Hear, hear.
Right? So I like to distill these into a little maxim, a little proverb that I kind of repeat to myself. So like if I'm, you know, interviewing or looking for work, it's like, would I want to become this person? Otherwise, I don't want to be working with you or for you. Things like, just as a reminder, when I want to buy something, is no one is as impressed with your possessions as you are.
Also very
So it's like, you see that guy stepping out of the Porsche, you don't think, oh, I want to be you. No, you know, you're not thinking that. You're thinking, you know, it's like, what's the matter with him? So there's, don't let your email box become your to-do list run by others.
Here, here, that's what I'm still working on.
Right. Maybe we need to feed that corpus into a bot and create the Kevin bot of, you know, daily advice.
Yes. People have talked about that, and that would be fun.
To consult before every important decision.
Right, exactly. I haven't yet done that, but I am going to do that to see if we can train it and have it make new ones. It would be kind of fun to do that.
It would be fun.
What's the bit that served you best in your life?
There's a couple, or maybe more career advice kind of stuff. My favorite one is, don't try to be the best. Try to be the only. The only is really where you want to be. You don't want to be like the best basketball player. First of all, it's very, very unlikely, and you're competing against a very small group. You want to be the only. You want to be the some guy, person, gal who's doing something with sports that nobody's ever done before. And that's a very high bar, to figure out what it is that you can do that nobody else can do. But if you can aim there and land there, that's the golden ticket. So another bit of advice, well, there's several things related to being the only versus the best, is you want to, if at all possible, work in an area where there's no words or names for what it is that you do. So 10 years ago, there were people who were doing podcasting. You know, they were trying to explain to their mother, it's like, well, it's kind of like radio, but it's not. It's sort of like audio document, you know, whatever it is. And so that meant that that was a very potent place to be because we didn't have the language for it. And so today you want to be somewhere where it would take some time to describe to your mother what it is that you do. That's a sign that you're in a kind of a good place. And the third bit is in your 20s, you should, if at all possible, spend a whole bunch of time, maybe a year, doing things that don't look anything like success. They're crazy, unpredictable, bizarre, strange, weird, unprofitable,
inefficient,
wasting time, whatever it is. It's like something that looks nothing like success. And that will become your foundational and touchstone for success later on. That experience of doing that thing.
And the thing you'll say at dinner parties for the rest of your life, the thing exactly. You'll talk about.
Right, exactly. Whether it's ride a bicycle around the world, whether it's building, you know, an ice sculpture that's in the shape of, you know, Godzilla, whatever it is.
You could ask generative AI.
Exactly, you could.
If you want
some help in doing something really strange. But yes, it will become a muse to you.
Kevin Kelly, thank you so much for talking to
us
today.
You're very welcome.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking time.
You've been listening to The Future This Week from the University of Sydney Business School. Sandra Peter is the Director of Sydney Business Insights, and Kai Reimer is Professor of Information Technology and Organisation. Connect with us on LinkedIn, Twitter, and WeChat, and follow, like, or leave us a rating wherever you get your podcasts. If you have any weird or wonderful topics for us to discuss, send them to sbi@sydney.edu.au.